ready. It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to the 59th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This time I've got a special San Diego Comic-Con edition. Although I'm not there, I'm still back in the East Coast. We get a report from Gianluca Glaser about how the con's going, and some news that's come out through the convention as well. I also talk with David Miller, a local comics creator, who has been to San Diego, and he and I compare our experiences and talk about memories and give some advice to folks who are going to attend in the future. Next, I'll give some comics reviews. And everything wraps up with a newly edited interview I did with Mark Wade, who talks about Irredeemable and Incorruptible and his comics history and his philosophy about writing. So we had a lot of interesting things to say. He even gives a little bit of a foreshadowing of what he's going to be doing now, talking about digital comics. So I think you'll enjoy that. We've got a lot to get to, so let's get to it. Okay, and it's time for a special edition of News and Previews, and back with me as always is Gianluca Glaser. Have you recovered from the Comic-Con, Gianluca?
I guess sleep-wise, yes. Feet-wise, maybe not as much. Thankfully, it wasn't the whole week of it.
Right.
Then I could say no.
Right. So what was your impression? I'm hearing there was a lot of people, that this was like a weekend day on a Thursday.
Yeah, Thursday was pretty busy. Just huge crowds as usual. Some people not there that had been there previously. I didn't notice anybody kind of new, but I'm sure there were. The whole hype thing about, oh, they're going to be stopping people and checking IDs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Never experienced any of that. I think that was just a lot of hype and scare, to be perfectly honest. It seemed the same. Security seemed the exact same as last year.
Okay. So I guess that's a good thing. Probably what they're aiming for is the weekend when they figure more people will be there.
Perhaps, yeah. It's just as big as usual. It's really interesting. I didn't do any of the Hall H stuff, so I didn't get to see any of the movie things. Mm-hmm. But a lot of publishers are just coming out with a lot of good, interesting stuff. You have Arkea there, Boom Studios. IDW had some special Comic-Con editions of The Score, Darwin Cook's new Parker book. Entertainment Earth, gosh, this company that releases a lot of toys and collectibles on licensed titles, they were showing Morgan Spurlock's documentary on the big screen, but the line just to buy things. Mm-hmm. You know, like they had like a special limited edition Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle action figures and things like that. Mm-hmm. The line was humongous. Mm-hmm. I've been there before, and I don't know, this was like 11 o'clock on a Thursday. I waited for over an hour.
Wow.
Not for any special signing, which they do have those, but just to simply buy something.
Wow. On a Thursday, no less. Wow.
On a Thursday at 11 o'clock.
Wow. So as far as walking around, the old thing about Comic-Con is that you get there Thursday, you can sort of walk around okay, and then Friday it tightens up more, and then Saturday it even tightens up farther than that. You basically have your 2 feet you can basically go. How was it as far as walking around? Was it like a typical Thursday, or was it busier?
It was busy. I mean, it depends what's going on, to be honest. Sideshow had a big traffic jam of people around them, so if you're up in the 2300 area in the back, expect to be delayed because people are either there seeing something on stage, or if there's free stuff being thrown around, that creates traffic jams. People posing for pictures, you know, creates jams all the time, and I always hated that. Mm-hmm. Especially if you're working and you have to reach certain people in certain areas, it's always a hassle. It's as crowded as usual, that's what I will say. I don't think it could get any crowded because they can't get any more people into the convention.
Okay. So anything else that stuck out to you while you were there?
I didn't get to see too many panels. I did show support for DeviantArt and Dave Elliott while I was there. It was really just a lot of me going around, seeing some people at Image Comics, seeing some people at Boom, saying hi to some people. One thing that really stuck out to me is this company, PCB Productions. Mm-hmm. They have a book that is coming out. I've never even heard of it till now. It's not going out through the typical Diamond channels. It's called Infects, and it's from this guy, Keith Arum, who is a producer for all the Call of Duty video games. And this graphic novel is like a video game. It's pricey, though. It's going to be a digital book, so it'll be a lot cheaper when it comes out later in the month, in July. But the hardcover book actually has like a metal cover, and it's $50.
Ooh.
Yeah, it is kind of pricey for an unknown title. The graphic novel looks like a video game. But the digital comic has all of these panels, and they are animated in such a way that I've never seen before. This really takes the capabilities of your iDevice to a whole new level. Once you see this, I'm going to start hyping this, because this thing is pretty darn amazing.
Wow, it's great. Okay, well, are we ready to go to other news then?
Absolutely, there's quite a bit.
Okay, why don't you go ahead?
All right. Neil Gaiman has announced that he's writing a new Sandman miniseries. It's going to be a prequel, and the artist is someone after my own heart, man. It's J.H. Williams III. I love his work. So
that's what he's been up to.
That is what he's got going on. Yes, so that was announced at one of DC's panels. DC also unveiled some new variant covers for upcoming issues of Before Watchmen. Paul Pope is doing Dr. Manhattan number 1. Steve Rude's doing Minutemen number 4. Jim Lee's got a Rorschach number 1. Tim Bradstreet's got a Comedian number 2. David Finch has a Night Owl number 2. Cliff Chang, Minutemen number 3. And Jim Steranko is also doing a Rorschach number 1. That's pretty cool.
He has drawn in a long time.
Oh, he does a lot of stuff, actually. He did a cover for that Archaea Planet of the Apes book, Conspiracy of Planet of the Apes.
Okay.
He does a lot of cover work. And then there's that Red Tide project that was in Dark Horse Presents number 3, which hasn't seen the light of day yet. He was revamping that graphic novel that he did a long time ago, back when I was born.
Wow. Okay.
Archaea has announced at San Diego that they're doing some digital first publications. One of the licensed Space 1999 book, which now it's 2012. As well as the gritty crime comic Mumbai Confidential. The first issue of these books will be available via Comixology. Both comic series will be collected then and published in hardcover editions, with the first volume of Space 1999 due in the last quarter of 2012. And the first Mumbai Confidential hardcover is set for early 2013. So, yeah, Archaea has moved away from doing single-issue books, with the exception of Mouse Guard. So it's not a big surprise that they are still doing some of that, but only as digital.
Interesting.
Dynamite Entertainment is bringing back Chaos Comics' Evil Ernie. It's got the creative team of writer Jesse Blade Snyder. He worked on Boom Studios' Toy Stories comics. But you know who his dad is?
Mm-mm.
It's Dee Snyder.
Oh.
We're not going to take it. No. Anyway, so, yes, he's working on...
Okay.
Artist is Jason Craig, who has worked on Freddy vs. Jason vs. Ash from Evil Dead.
Okay.
And it's going to ship in stores in October.
Oh, cool. So,
other Dynamite news, they have announced that Alex Ross is going to be doing interior artwork for the first time since 2007.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing the entire first issue artwork for Mask, a crossover comic book series that's going to feature their top Pulp Fiction crime characters, like the Black Bat, the Shadow, the Green Hornet, Zorro, Kato, Miss Fury, the Spider. So this huge crossover event is going to bring back Alex Ross into doing some interiors.
Great.
Yeah. Oh, your favorite writer, man. He's got some great news coming out.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Mr. Straczynski.
That's right.
Oh, boy.
He has announced Studio JMS.
Oh,
a
boy.
A new media company that handles its output across a variety of platforms, including movies, TV series, comic books, and web series. One of the key elements will be a revival of Joe's Comics. JMS private comic label imprint at Top Cow lasted originally from 2000 to 2004. His four comics announced for his imprint revival, which is going to be published through Image Comics, are Sidekick, Falling Angel, 10 grand, and Guardians. Also, you can't get enough JMS. He's doing a book over at Legendary Comics. It's called The Majestic Files. It'll be a retelling of the Roswell myth and the alien landing there.
Majestic Files, that what it was?
That's what it's called, yeah.
Majestic Files, okay.
Yes, so the art will be done by Jeff Shaw and Matt Banning.
Mm. He's busy.
He is a busy guy. I know you love him.
Oh, my.
Other Legendary news, the big nerd merger going on. Legendary Pictures has acquired Nerdist Industries, the multi-platform nerd news founded by The Talking Dead's Chris Hardwick. Nerdist frontman Chris Hardwick and CEO Peter Levin will remain in place and will also be co-presidents of Legendary's digital business.
Huh.
Very interesting. The deal calls for Nerdist to maintain complete editorial autonomy and operations while benefiting from Legendary Entertainment's resources and platforms as the company continues to offer up quality, quote-unquote, fanboy content to audiences around the world. It'll also allow Nerdist to scale up its activities.
Interesting.
Very interesting, because Legendary Pictures has Legendary Comics. Now they've acquired the Nerdist guys, so they have their own means of publicity now.
All right. Especially because they're online people, too. This is the way that nerds and nerdists basically communicate, is through online things. So, like, podcasting and things like that. So that'll be really interesting. That's fascinating.
It is fascinating. Chris Hardwick gets a new fat paycheck as well, too.
Yeah.
He's now on Legendary staff.
Wow.
Yeah. Bongo Comics, who usually does Simpson comic books, they've announced a 6-issue comic book miniseries based on Coldplay's 2011 album, Milo Zilato.
Mm-hmm.
So a special official spokesperson for the band has said, 3 years ago, we had an idea with our friend Mark Osborne about a character called Milo Zilato. Zilo as in xylophone and toe as in, I guess, the foot toe.
Okay.
Gradually, Milo's story and universe came together, and this ended up providing the backdrop for the album and tour. Now we're proud to announce that early next year, the story is going to come out as a 6-part comic. We hope you like it. It was fun making it.
Wow.
So, yes, the story is this, interesting enough. It's about Milo Zilato, a young silencer in the front lines of a war against sound and color in the world of Silencia. Milo discovers that the enemy he's been trained to hate his whole life might not be the enemy after all. There will hopefully be many, many connections for people who have heard this album. I'm beyond thrilled to say it turned out. That was an official spokesperson quote. Issue 1 goes on sale February 2013.
Wow.
And last week or whatever, I mentioned to you, we talked about Marvel Now, big event for them.
Right.
Well, I didn't get to mention it because it hadn't come out yet at that time, but Marvel is releasing a new title every week, starting in October and then ending in February. But while they add these new titles, they plan to cancel 9 titles in October.
Right.
So the titles listed as being canceled are big ones: Captain America, Fantastic Four, FF, Incredible Hulk, Invincible Iron Man, New Mutants, The Mighty Thor, Uncanny X-Men, and X-Men Legacy. Yes.
Interesting. They're going to replace some of those. I think Captain America is getting a new number one, if
probably.
I remember correctly. So it's very likely those will be replaced with other ones, but we'll see what they decide to do.
Oh, I mean, yeah, you're going to see these come back. Captain America is going to come back without Brubaker this time.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic Four, Incredible Hulk. These characters aren't going to get killed off permanently. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're being rebooted.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
That's it for news.
All right. Let me throw in a couple things for you if you have some other stuff. Sean Aldridge, the creator of Vic Boone Now, is going to be doing a prequel to the character, kind of show how he got to be the way he is, which I like. I always like that comic. It's a great one. It's from 215 Inc., and it's underestimated by people, I think. It's just a great book.
Sure.
And the other thing that I know of is David Peterson, the guy from Mouse Guard, just won the MTV Geek Pitch Live, beating out pitches by Mark Silvestri and Kevin Eastman. So we're going to see what that's
about. What's the award?
MTV Geek Pitch Live.
Okay.
And
pitch live. Like, he's pitching live to people? Hey, I got a story about a mouse.
I think so. But, you know, I don't know more about it. He's going to release more about that. They just announced that he had won. Of course, anytime you beat up Mark Silvestri and Kevin Eastman, that's a big deal.
That is pretty big.
So he's going to be talking more about that in the future. But I just thought I'd mention that because I really love Moss Garden and that stuff. So, any other stuff we should talk about before we get to previews?
No. Really.
Okay. All right. What are you looking forward to then?
Well, there's quite a few interesting titles. Concrete, Three Easy Pieces, One Shot comes out from Dark Horse, and this collects the Concrete stories that were brought back and then relaunched Dark Horse Presents. Batwoman number 11 comes out. It's the issue before J.H. Williams returns as the interior artist. IDW has Mars Attacks number 2. I haven't read number 1 yet, so.
Okay.
Marvel has the Infernal Man-Thing number 2. Steve Gerber's Last Untold Man-Thing epic continues. So, a lot of people don't know this, but Man-Thing is not a ripoff of Swamp Thing. Man-Thing actually came out before Swamp Thing. It's true. But they're both not the original Muck Monsters that have been out prior.
Right.
Kaboom, Boom's Kids line, has Adventure Time number 6. It's a very popular book.
Mm-hmm.
Boom itself has Elric Balance of the Lost number 11. This is the second and final issue of the series. They also have Snarked number 10 from Roger Langridge. They also have a trade paperback of Clive Barker's Hellraiser Volume 3, Heaven's Reply.
Oh, wow.
And if you didn't get to read their Hypernatural book by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, they have a second printing of that coming out.
Right.
This is all July 18th.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other interesting titles is 12 Gauge Comic has Luke McBain trade paperback.
Okay.
And it's written by David Tishman. The art is by the very talented Cody Chamberlain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's country music superstar Tracy Atkins is Luke McBain. A man who returns to his small southern hometown after spending 14 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. I'm imagining there's a lot of butt kicking that's going to go on there.
Yeah,
from Luke McBrain. And then, if you're a literary person, you may have heard of Flannery O'Connor. I did. I grew up in Memphis, but she's a southern writer. She did the gothic horror genre. She did a lot of famous short stories, including A Good Man is Hard to Find. A lot of really great dark writing. She died at a really young age, in her early 40s, from lupus. And her stories are classics. One of her novels, she wrote two novels. One of them, called Wise Blood, was made into a movie. It was directed by John Huston. It starred Brad Dourif. Great thing. But what I never knew was that she was actually a cartoonist, as well as a writer. And Fantagraphics has finally released Flannery O'Connor, the Cartoons hardcover, which I got to pick up at the show.
Oh, great.
I have that a week ahead of all y'all.
Oh, great. Well, that's good. Okay, let me run down a couple. Actually, I'll run up. I'll go the other direction. Exo Manowar number 3 is coming out from Valiant. Warlord of Mars, Dage of Thoris number 13 is out. They've collected the Warehouse 13 books from Dynamite into a trade that's out. The Spider number 3 by David Lisk is out, which is a good book. Mm-hmm. And Rachel Rising number 9 is also out, a very weird little book. If you like Strange and Wonderful, that's the book for you. Then there is the Incorruptible trade paperback. I'm going to be talking with Mark Waid shortly about that, so that's one definitely worth getting. As far as Marvel goes, Avengers Academy number 33, rumor was going around that it was going to be done, but instead it's going on, and it's not going to end as people thought it might. Speaking of Mr. Waid, Daredevil number 15 is coming out, so that'll be a good one worth getting. Star Trek Ongoing from IDW Publishing number 11 comes out, which is always a good one. There are a bunch of Dark Knight Rises statues. There's a Bane, a Batman, and a Catwoman, all running for $80 each. So those will be something worth getting, especially as the movie draws near. Then from DC, we'll have Young Justice, number 18, Wonder Woman, Supergirl, Nightwing, Red Hood and the Outlaws, Legion of Superheroes, Justice League, number 11, Green Lantern Corps, number 11, DC Universe Presents, and Catwoman, Captain Atom, Blue Beetle, Birds of Prey, and Before Watchmen, Silk Spectre, number 2, which is written but not drawn by Darwin Cook. So it's really good. No, I got that book, the
The Score?
the score, and I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but boy, it looks good. When I was carrying it around in the store, everyone was going, is that how did that come out? Yes, I said, and I ordered it, so you can't have it. Because I really want that. Okay, and I guess that's it for the traveling news and previews this time. Good as always, talk with you, Jean-Luc. We'll talk with you again next week.
Sure, thanks very much.
Welcome back to the show, David Miller, comics creator of good things, including Avatar the Futurians and Writer's Block and other good things like that. How are you doing today, David?
Oh, doing great. How are you, Wayne?
Good. I thought while Comic-Con is going on, and maybe some folks listening to it later on will pick up the podcast after Comic-Con's over, but I thought while it's going on, we would talk about some memories. And you've been to Comic-Con a lot more than I have. I've only been there once. You were telling me before we started to record, this is the 20th anniversary of your first time?
Yes, I went in 1992, and that was, I think it's like maybe the second year when it was really considered this big media festival, almost like Sundance in the summer. Mm-hmm. And some things happened there that really opened my eyes as to how big this thing had gotten.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by then it started to balloon into what it is now. I think it's 1977, 78 is when the first one,
mm-hmm.
when it was very small, 300 people.
Mm-hmm.
By 92, it was still kind of homey. It was still a lot about comics, but Hollywood was definitely starting to put its foot in the door back then.
Uh-huh.
Two things happened that was really huge at the time.
Mm.
Image made a big announcement that they were Image.
Mm.
That was their first presence there as a company, as an organized company. That was huge. I think the speculative market had just exploded with the death of Superman.
Mm.
So money was just flying back and forth. I mean, it was just a big time for comics.
Mm.
The other thing that blew my mind at the time, because I still was thinking, yeah, this is a big comics convention,
mm-hmm.
but they were going to have a panel for Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula.
Ooh.
I said, oh, that's cool. So I went and I thought, okay, the studio will send some rep, they'll show a trailer and do a little Q&A and it'll be over. But I get there and Francis Ford Coppola walks out.
Hmm.
And I was like, what? You know, mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it. And he showed the trailer for Dracula and he did the Q&A and I thought, wow, I wasn't expecting this. And that's when I realized that San Diego was definitely a different animal than all the other conventions. It was still kind of homey and still kind of big time. So it was like, I really think it was like a great year to go, especially for my first time.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many times have you been there?
Let's see. Oh, wow. I guess about five. Four,
okay.
Five, definitely four. Unfortunately, 2 years ago, I was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Had my pass, had my plane ticket. I get to the airport, and the connecting airport, which I think was Milwaukee, was flooded out.
Oh.
So my flight got delayed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, unfortunately, I played it a little too close to the vest, and I had interviews I wanted to do,
mm-hmm.
and because of the delay of the flight, I would have missed them, so I just canceled the whole trip.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't worth it to chase around Kenneth Branagh to get his autograph.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a lot to do. It's just so huge. You were there.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't you feel like you were a leaf in a whirlwind?
Yeah. Well, now, of course, the thing is it used to be everything was contained inside the convention center, but now it's literally spilled over into hotels all around it. You walk up streets to go to restaurants. Whole restaurants are being taken over. There was a pizza place that was taken over by Cartoon Network when I was there. There's a restaurant that's taken over by Sci-Fi, and they call it Cafe Diem, like in Eureka. And so it's just everywhere, and it's just forever. I mean, you just go along, and there's so many things, so many places to go, that it's so hard to get everything in and get to it. And the things that you warned me about were so true, and some other folks have warned me about, is that sometimes you have to sit in an auditorium a couple of hours before the thing you want to go to actually starts to happen, so that you're there when it happens. Otherwise, you try to get in there just in time for that, you won't make it.
So true what you said, Wayne, but I remember a landmark that helps me remember the last time I went, because when I went, the big deal was the premiere of True Blood on HBO.
Oh.
And I remember it because I remember I was in a hotel and the elevator doors opened up and the interior walls of the elevators were all these huge face posters of the cast. You know, it was just like taking a poster but blowing it up so big, It was from floor to ceiling of the elevator and wrapped all the way around. There were also, well, not quite skyscrapers, but tall buildings they had painted on True Blood wall paintings. I still don't know how they do that. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's amazing how you're so big 1 year and kind of forgotten the next. I'm sure Walking Dead is going to have a huge presence there.
Yeah.
But that's the last time I went. It's the year True Blood premiered. Mm-hmm. And it's something. The other nice memory I have is I stepped out of the convention center to get something to eat, and these hawkers were throwing around flyers, right? And they said, hey, come see our movie. It was the movie of the comedy, Accepted, by the guy who makes up a college because he doesn't get accepted anywhere mm-hmm. to fool his parents.
Mm-hmm.
He said, come see our movie. You can see our movie as like a market research. And if you'll come see it afterwards, we'll take you to a barbecue to eat. And I was like, wow, I wanted to do it, but that was like had me out of the convention for 3 or 4 hours. I just didn't want to go all the way to the West Coast to see a movie. I wanted to spend time in the convention center, although I wish I'd gone just for the experience.
Yeah. But interesting things that happened with me, because last year was the first time and the only time I've been there so far. There were several things that happened that really hit me as kind of interesting. You walk around and there are so many people dressed up in costume, and usually they fit the costumes real well. But every once in a while you see a Superman or a Supergirl that should not be in the costume, you know, or Batman running around. They just want to wear the costume and they don't care how they look in it. But I've seen like Silver Surfer running around. He was actually not too bad. He was painted silver. Wonder how he breathes through all that. And you'd see a lot of interesting costumes. I mean, some of them were pretty well made. There was an Iron Man walking around with a Jedi, and the poor guy in the Iron Man outfit, just, he could not breathe. And I was sitting against the wall at one point, and he was in front of me getting his picture taken, and he turned to the Jedi guy and he says, I have to get out of this thing now, he goes. And so off they go to try to get him out of the uniform. I wonder how long it was going to take him to actually physically get out of that thing. It looked very accurate, I'll give it that. That really looked good. Well, one thing that struck me last year, I had all these business cards printed up. I took a couple hundred out there with me so I could hand them out to people so people would know who the heck I was. And so I handed out a whole bunch of cards, and after the con was over, I came back and I tried to follow up with the people who had given me their cards. And when I called them, every single person who gave me their card, I said to them, do you still have my card? Oh, well, if people give us so many of those, we just throw those out after the con's over. So I wasted all that money and all that time handing out my little business cards, and I probably, next time I'm just never going to take a business card with me. I'm just going to take their cards.
You know what the flip side is to that story you're telling me?
What?
When I was going early on, I was going looking for work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd meet people, sometimes editors, sometimes TV producers and stuff, and I would have sample packets ready and prepared, and they'd say, yeah, leave me your Xeroxes. I said, okay. And I found out later that all these sample packets are like, you know, spend lots of money making Xeroxes and mm-hmm. putting them in packets, stapling business cards too, that they just threw right in the trash when we left.
Oh, because that was the thing with me here. I thought all these people would know who the heck I was, and nothing could be further from the truth. It was really kind of sad. Like I said, next time I'm not taking all them cards. I'll take a couple just in case. And the one thing, my friend John Luca, he and I talked about the fact that he wanted to get in shape. And I thought, get in shape? I said, I've been to cons my whole life and I never had to get in shape for it. But boy, I wish I had gotten in shape. I wish I had listened to him last year, because when I got there, I would walk around and take the tram back and forth and stuff. And when I get to the place I was staying, I would just collapse in a heap because I'd been walking around this convention center. And there's very few places to actually sit. So you get exhausted by the end of it. It is just miles and miles of walking. And next time I go, I'm going to be in better shape. I'm really convinced of it.
Oh, it is huge. Not only walking the 2 miles back and forth on the convention floor,
mm-hmm.
you might want to take a step outside. You're right. It's huge. And I think Mark Ebener said it best when he said about this con. He said, San Diego is a bunch of cons all rolled into one.
Yeah.
And you got to find the con that's right for you.
Yeah.
Whether you're going to go to just stay on the comics convention floor, or go up to the panels, or go to the like B-list syndicated actors autograph room, which, by the way, I love.
Mm-hmm.
I love being able to be that close to the actors.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, as a reporter,
mm-hmm.
is trying to cover all of that,
mm-hmm.
it's like there's going to be like 5 Wayne Halls covering the 5 different conventions.
You know, the trouble I had last year is everybody was sending out all these email news releases, and I was running from place to place in the building, and I knew less about what was happening at the con than the people who were receiving the emails did. So if I'm going to do stuff, I'm literally going to have to carry around my iPad and stuff with me and just pay attention to all the emails that they're sending out, because I literally had no idea what was going on compared to other people who were you know, hundreds of miles away, they had a better idea as to what kind of news was being released. So,
and if you're going to do that, I often read Heidi McDonald's column, and she always talks about the quest for the hotspot.
Yeah.
Because, yes, there is Wi-Fi in the convention center, but you can lose it very easily when you're walking. So you maybe stake out all the hot spots first and know where you can go.
Would you recommend people go? And if they go, what would you recommend they do?
Well, if you actually can get a pass online, you've cleared a huge hurdle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And hit the website and learn the rules. Like this year, they sent out another email saying strollers are restricted from the convention floor. So if you were going to go and you were going to bring a stroller to help carry your stuff, you're going to find yourself in a situation where you either got to figure out what to do with your stroller or something else. So hitting the updates on the website to know what you can and can't bring, following the rules that they put out is really the best. And after that, good footwear, supportive footwear, whether you think that's going to be hiking boots or a good tennis shoe, hard sole shoes, I advise against it.
You can download an app for the con, too, that helps. They'll put out little papers that say what's been canceled and what's been moved and stuff like that. But people have always told me that the app is better. If you can download it to whatever phone you've got, an Android or an iPhone or something like that, that is a much easier way to keep track of what's going on. But the one thing I would advise to people is, like we talked about, be sure to stand in line several hours ahead of time. I wanted to watch the first episode of Person of Interest, and I stood in line for 2 hours, and I realized we weren't getting anywhere near the theater where that was going to be shown, and I kept asking people, are we still going to get in there? Are we still going to get in there? Even 10 minutes after the episode was supposed to have started, they kept promising us, yes, we would get in there, and finally, somebody came around and said, no, you're not going to get in there, after about 20 minutes too late, and I said, well, I knew that was going to happen because I couldn't imagine that the programming was going to run 20 minutes behind like that. So I would say if you're going to have to be somewhere, get there 3 hours ahead of time and wear suntan lotion because you're going to be standing out. And the trick of it is the lines, they move little by little. You don't get to sit in one place very long. They move and move and move and move. So if you're going to try to do something online, good luck. That's very hard to do.
Yeah, all the big ticket media, actors, movie things, you're going to have very difficult lines to negotiate. If you're looking for niche things, like with artists, you know, people who aren't quite there yet, that's where you'll have it easier, and you might actually be able to find someone on the ground floor whose career is about to take off, and no one knows it yet. It's almost worth it to stake out the guys you can get at who look promising, and you can say, I knew you when type thing.
Yeah. If you're a comics guy, do you think it's worth going to still, or do you think it's more turned into a media type of convention?
Well, the comics companies still have a big presence there. I don't know if they still have regular portfolio reviews, although I think it's an institution now to have the portfolio reviews. But it's been like 1 year, Mike Richardson at Dark Horse made a promise to read every submission that was given at Comic-Con. And I happened to actually submit something that year. And I got a personal handwritten or hand-signed letter that spoke about details about my project. So I knew he had to have typed it because it wasn't just, we don't want your project. He named it and said some things about it. So things like that will happen. The rules are currently changing, Wayne, and you have to be nimble and look at it. I think comics companies think, okay, if you've got something and you're savvy at all, you should put it online. If we see it online and we like it, then you can follow up at Comic-Con, say, hey, I do blah, blah, blah online, and if it's got a bit of a following, then you can talk. I can't give you a good answer right now because the rules are changing, but the thing is, you can't play if you don't go type of thing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I found helpful is following up with people, making face-to-face contact. There were a couple of comics creators I wanted to interview for the podcast. And I was able to eye-to-eye with folks and tell them so they knew who I was. I wasn't just some name that they spoke with over the phone. I was a person that they could relate to. So I found that really helpful. That was probably the most productive thing about it. Also, if you have a lot of stuff you want to buy, you can buy a lot of things out there. Some of the comics dealers will have stores on the floors, and you can go around and buy. And of course, like I was there, of course, Wednesday is when the books come out, and if you're traveling on Wednesday, you want to pick up stuff. And some of them have books out there. Of course, you can get autographs. If you're big on autographs, you can get those out there as well. I would say if you're a professional looking for work, you're going to have to find some way to stand out in the crowd. Otherwise, it's probably best to go to a smaller con like maybe New York or something like that.
Well, if you're talking about a professional, then that's different, you know, who you assume knows some editors and have contacts. If you're talking about a young hopeful, that's what I was kind of talking about a few minutes ago.
Do you think maybe next year you might get it to go back there?
I just might. They changed the registering process online. Mm-hmm. So I dragged my heels. So that's why I didn't get registered this year. Mm-hmm. The other years, I was just able to log on with my old ID real quick, and I was in. So I'm going to have to actually look at the website this year.
I've got to find a better place to stay. The lady I stayed with last year was very nice and very cordial, but at the last minute, a couple of days before, she canceled on me, and that's why I didn't get to go this year. So I'm probably going to have to try to make a hotel reservation next year just to be sure that I can get in there. And if she comes through at the end, well, I can always cancel that. I don't have to worry about the hotel reservations. They'll get other people. But that's probably what I'll have to do next year. We'll have to get a whole bunch of us going out there, and that way we can get a room and all bunk in together and travel back and forth and stuff like that.
Yeah, it definitely takes planning. I was always envious of my friends that lived in California, in L.A., but it was still just a little two-hour drive. You know, they could actually do it in one day, do a day trip if they wanted.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. It's something. Well, David, I know you're in the middle of good things. Nothing you can announce currently, though, I understand.
Yes, I have entered a juried show in the Manassas Arts Center, which I've been accepted in. It's called the Candy Factory Show. You can see it online at the Manassas Arts Center, and it's in August. I have to deliver my framed pieces at the end of July, which I've already got framed.
Great.
So, fortunately, I had some frames hanging around. So that's going to be fun to be part of a show.
Okay. Well, good luck with that, and I hope things go on. Hopefully, you're making comics again sometime soon.
Well, who knows? Thanks for having me on, Wayne, and you have a good day.
Okay, you too.
Hey, this is Crazy Joe.
And this is Dave, host of Megapodzilla,
the podcast equivalent to a 100-foot radioactive robot lizard,
but with horn-rimmed glasses and a pocket protector.
That's nerdy. We're on the rampage, laying waste to the geek landscape.
We'll talk movies, TV, comics, toys, video games.
And sometimes we talk turkey.
Don't you mean chicken?
That's right. So check us out at Megapodzilla.com.
We're also available on iTunes and the Zune Marketplace.
Aw, yeah.
Faster than a speeding bullet. Powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Wayne's Comic Review.
Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands. And now, another exciting episode.
Now let's take a look at this week's comics. This week was a particularly good week for comics. There were so many great ones, I had a hard time picking up my comic of the week. So let me list a couple. Batman number 11 is the conclusion to the Court of Owls storyline that's been going on ever since the New 52 began. And it's an interesting one. I really liked it very well. I think Mr. Snyder and Mr. Capullo have put themselves into the Batman Hall of Fame with this amazing storyline. And now they're going to move on to the Joker, which I think is interesting. The pacing is great, the art's gripping, and the book is a very strong conclusion. The only quibble I had with the whole thing was that Batman is in a jet engine while his brother, we don't know if he's Owlman or the Owl or what he's going to be called, he's talking with him, and I'm not sure how he could hear over that engine noise. But anyway, that's a small quibble compared to the rest of the stuff. It's a great book, and it's a must-read conclusion to the end of a storyline that has started and been going for a year. And unlike Avengers vs. X-Men, this is definitely worth the read. Another great book that came out is Hoax Hunters number 1. It's the first full issue of what was a backup in Hack Slash. And Michael Morrissey is involved with it. Of course, he's from Quarantine fame. Very good book. And Alex Medellin is doing the art. And it's a wonderful book. It's an interesting blend of X-Files, Challengers of the Unknown, BPRD, and Supernatural. You don't know what's going to happen next. And it's a very interesting thing. It's a show in which people are supposed to be debunking these paranormal things. And in actuality, they're trying to hide them from the real world. And it's kind of an interesting story. I like the group. Very good book. Be sure to buy it. Issue 0 came out, which collected the previous stories that were in the back of Hack Slash.
Flash, so you want to get that. Another great book is The Walking Dead 100. It's called Something to Fear, a well-known and well-liked character that's been around basically since the start of The Walking Dead, buys the farm this time, and I'm not going to tell you who. You're going to have to pick up the book to find out. It's got about 8 different covers, which you can get. Great stuff all. It's just interesting to see what's going on. Let's just say that somebody who's going to give the governor a run for his money as an evil baddie rises up in this book, so something definitely worth getting. Another terrific book you're going to want to be sure to have, this one, is Richard Stark's Parker the Score, which is done by Darwin Cook. It comes out from IDW. It's the third of the bunch that he's done so far, and boy, have they been great books. Great comic translations into a hardcover. So you're going to want to get that book, believe me. If you haven't gotten the previous ones, be sure to get them. This week's New 52 reviews. I have some quick thoughts on the New 52 books that came out. Batgirl continues to be one of the very best DC offerings, and this month has the first part of Nightfall, a storyline that'll go on for a while. Swamp Thing finishes the setup before the crossover with Animal Man. Batman and Robin, meanwhile, has Damian taking on the other Robins. Demon Knights number 11 by Paul Cornell travels to Camelot, and interesting things happen there. The Ravagers has the group fighting Brother Blood. Also, Superboy number 11 has the Teen of Steel teaming up with Bunker from the Teen Titans. Deathstroke fights Lobo in his book. Resurrection Man begins with Mitch using shadow powers, and he gets to change powers during the book, of course. Legion Lost sees the group attacked by the Metamarines, while Suicide Squad shows the team venturing into the land of the Mayans. Grifter is exploring his new power, but that book was still the least of the New 52. Not too bad, though. Other books worth picking up include Batman Arkham Unhinged number 4, Before Watchmen the Minuteman number 2 by the aforementioned Darwin Cook, Green Lantern the Animated Series number 4, Shade number 10, and Saucer Country from Paul Cornell number 5 from DC Comics. Marvel has Takio number 2 and Venom number 20. From IDW, there's also The Lock and Key Volume 5 Clockworks hardcover. This is the last one before the final group appears. Atomic Robo Real Science Adventures number 4 comes out from Red 5, and also Kevin Smith's Bionic Man number 10 comes out from Dynamite. Very good stuff. And those are the books that came out this week.
This is Wayne Hall, and we're talking with Mark Waid, a veteran comics writer, editor, and many good things. And I want to talk about past projects with you, Mark. And how are you doing today, Mark?
Doing great, Wayne. Thanks.
I've been a fan of yours for a long time, to be honest. I remember reading Amazing Heroes, a fanzine, which we don't get much of these days, about comics, and you wrote one of the best responses I ever read to a big, long argument. There, somebody was writing in there about how the X-Men could beat Superman, and there was this long paragraph after paragraph about it, and at the very end, you got to the end. So, well, you know, all that could be true, or it could be that your Wolverine t-shirt's on too tight.
That's true. And you know what? I can still use that rejoinder, sadly. So, yeah.
I did it for a little while. I used to use that, but it was just such a wonderful bet. But you've had a long experience writing with comic characters, and I know you're in a new phase now. I thought we could, for just a couple minutes, talk about where you've come from. The first time that I really noticed your writing as a comic book person was The Return of Barry Allen, which to me, I think in many ways exemplifies your writing. Oftentimes, the solution is hiding in plain sight, and if we sit and think about it, we'll figure it out. I remember sitting down and realizing this was Professor Zoom instead of Barry Allen that was there, and when I realized it, I thought, holy smoke. I said, Wally West is never going to survive. But instead, you had already planted the seeds in front of us to show how he was going to survive, and not only that, but thrive from that point on with the Speed Force.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, when you write, does that just happen naturally with you, or is that something that you plan for when you write?
It's funny. Graham Morrison and I talked about this not too long ago, because we were talking about how there's something about, you know, actually, here's the long answer to that question is that I think that a lot of my training as a writer came from the stuff I read voraciously when I was a kid, and it wasn't so much comics, although I certainly read every comic I could get my hands on, but I was also a huge fan growing up of reading detective stories, of reading especially whodunits and solve-it-yourself mysteries and so forth. So I think that on a DNA level, that notion of planting clues and hiding the solution in plain sight is kind of upon me already. It's already baked in my DNA. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really realize it until years later, as I realized that I tend to write without a whole lot of idea of where I'm going. I mean, the general idea, I mean, every writer needs to know basically where his story ends or where he's headed in a general direction. But specifically, I find that I'm always sort of plotting myself into a corner, no idea how to get out of this cliffhanger, or no idea how to resolve the storyline. And then I look back on the last three or four issues I wrote, and sure enough, as if I did it instinctively without even realizing it, there is there's a trail of breadcrumbs there, if I look closely, to pick up on. And so the beauty of that is that Grant and I both talked about, because he has a tendency to do a little bit of that too, it's that it's almost like you're subconsciously doing that to save your future self from shame and disaster. And the beauty of it is that it's largely accidental, but you get the benefit of it looking like you did it on purpose and you're a genius. So I'm completely down with that.
Well, I feel sort of sorry, because I did think you were a genius and had planned all these things in advance.
And now I've spoiled it for you, so.
Bust the tech bubble. I'm sure there are times when this does happen. I think like the return of Barry Allen, for example, you must have had.
I did. I mean, that was close to 20 years ago, too. So holy God, really? Yes, holy wow, that was close to 20 years ago. Jeez. So, yeah, but, you know, back then I had a little more youthful energy and vigor and vim and trepidation and was a lot more structured in what I did. I think that, and this is true of pretty much everybody in any sort of creative field, the longer you're at it, the looser you get and the more improv you tend to be about what it is you do, just because you built up the skill set enough where you can sort of go off on flights of fancy a little bit more and don't have to stick to the script as much, and because your level of craft has increased. But if you choose to believe that I am secretly a devious plotting machine and genius who lays all this out for years ahead of time, then by all means, please don't let me dissuade your your enthusiasm for that.
Well, it just kills me because, you know, I can't imagine writing myself into a corner and then suddenly decide, you know, what happens if you can't find a way out? But I guess, as you've said, there is a part of you that knows where you're going, and you just have to find out where that is.
I really think that's it. I mean, my philosophy about writing myself into a corner, which I do frequently with cliffhangers, is and it just drives my editors nuts, because, you know, I'll turn in something and, you know, well, how does he get out of that? And I'll look at him and go, honestly, I'll go, I don't know. But I guess my philosophy has become, you know, if I don't know, then you can't guess. Mm-hmm. And then we'll both be surprised. And won't that be wonderful?
Well, it's a wonderful surprise to read. You know, when you get to the conclusion, it just feels to me like it's just, well, why didn't I notice that? You know, there wasn't.
Well, thank you.
It was on such in plain sight. I mean, like, for example, when you wrote the Justice League story, when Batman had all these ways to, if he had to, take down his fellow members.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was this wonderful plot idea that was, and when we get to the end, we come to discover, you know, Ra's al Ghul was the one that took all those things,
yeah,
and was using them. Again, a great, great plot. And I just think that you take characters where we don't see them go. And an example that jumps right to mind is the Fantastic Four you did, where Dr. Doom actually decides to use magic against Reed Richards.
Yeah, it's been part of his backstory for forever, and it always struck me as odd that it's the one thing that you can do that Mr. Fantastic has no clue about and cannot match you on, so why are you not using that weapon more and more? Why do you never pull that out of your toolbox?
I think that's what makes you a great writer for established characters, is you kind of look for those little areas where something different has not been explored. I mean, you're right, it's really obvious his mother was a gypsy witch, but he never tapped into that past before.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I take great pride in doing that. I think that that's the fun of working with long-established characters, is really being able to look at them in a fresh light. It's not because I'm a genius. It's just because, A, I've been living with these characters and thinking about them since I was six, and B, having read most of these stories, I kind of instinctively know what has already been done and what hasn't been done, at least to a large extent.
Mm-hmm. I did want to ask, are there any established characters that you'd still like to go back and write stories for?
Now, someday I'll get my crack at Superman, if there's any justice in the universe. I mean, my long-term crack at Superman, that would be a lot of fun. But beyond that, I honestly don't know. I used to say DC's Captain Marvel, that was my go-to, and I still feel like I could hit that one out of the park, because I've been thinking about that for years. But to be honest with you, this gets back to Fantastic Four for a moment. I mean, my choice on collaborators of that was always Michael Ringo, who was one of my best friends and the artist with me on Fantastic Four and so many other things. And when he passed away unexpectedly a few years ago, I'm still torn. I know Mike, he would not want me to stop thinking about Captain Marvel, but at the same time, it's a little bittersweet at this point. Maybe I'd like my crack at that at some point, but then again, maybe it's time to think about other things. I don't know. But that's, that's, again, long answer to your short question, but maybe Superman someday.
Well, that would be great, but we'll get to Irredeemable here shortly, because in a way that is a Superman sort of character.
In a way, it certainly started out as a slight turn on the Superman myth that I think I'm proud to say has really very quickly gone past that and now is not really a Superman analog story anymore. So. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because Irredeemable to me is very much of a scary story. One of the most frightening things I ever read was when the Plutonian is there at the United Nations and everybody is, the one person is trying to say we need to rebel against this person and he's dead. And then all of a sudden then the Plutonian says, you were going to give me all this stuff. Please continue. And then, of course, he finds the one person that he talks to and realizes that they're lying and basically destroys their country. That still gives me the shivers, even now talking about it. I just sort of like, wow, this is really scary stuff. If Superman had gone bad, kind of a setup. Obviously, you know, your interest in Superman, probably this is where some of the ideas came from. But was there anything specific when you created Irredeemable that you were interested in accomplishing with that?
Well, yeah, it really came less out of a specific Superman, Captain America, Captain Marvel paradigm, then it sprang out of the notion of what is it like to be a superhero in the 21st century with the paparazzi and with celebrity culture and TMZ, you know, and Perez Hilton and the internet all on you 100% of the time. And what is it like to try to do good in a world where we are just so crazy, insanely judgmental 24/7? And so quick to, I don't mean this to, this is dangerous because I don't mean this to sound as if, you know, the next thing you expect of me is to stand on my lawn and wave my cane and tell the kids to get off my porch. But I could be wrong. And maybe this is just the mist of nostalgia, but I want to remember that growing up, people weren't so incredibly quick to rage and anger. I want to remember that if you didn't like something, you know, you kind of just ignored it rather than, I will admit I'm old enough to remember a time when the word sucks was not in the American lexicon, was not a word that people used. And especially in the internet culture, in the internet age, for all the good that's come out of it, one of the things that seems to come out of it is that snap judgment seems to be perfected. The concept of the snap judgment we have perfected in the 21st century. You either like it or you hate it. And you always got an opinion on it, no matter what. And I would imagine that would be a very tough world in which to navigate if you're trying to make the world a better place and you're actively out there doing things. I mean, celebrities who are not even trying to do anything other than get their face on the screen and earn millions of dollars doing movies and stuff, mm-hmm. or explore their art or their craft, you know, look at the crap they got to put up with, websites dedicated to hating them, and there's no one in America, in celebrity culture, that I'm sure doesn't have some sort of I hate website dedicated to them. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, man, that's tough sledding if you have the power to see and hear everything all at once all over the world, mm-hmm. and have a hard time screening that out, mm-hmm. and B, if you are fundamentally flawed in that the whole reason you got into being a superhero was to be loved and accepted and embraced, mm-hmm. which is not the case with most superheroes. I mean, most superheroes are motivated by nobler things, and the Plutonian's fatal flaw, of course, is that, as we've sort of come to learn, his fatal flaw is that he's in it for all the wrong reasons. He wasn't a bad guy, but, you know, alien and alone and apart and shunned by people. And unlike Clark Kent, who was adopted by two loving parents who nurtured him and brought him up and taught him their values, you know, Plutonian as an orphan boy was adopted by a string of people who would take him in and then be terrified by the power he had, and he would be rejected and thrown back in the orphan pool. And it's got to do a number on you, and it's got to make you want to be loved and want to be embraced. I guess what I'm saying is that I really have given a lot of thought to that over the years. At what point do you snap? Mm-hmm. If you're trying to do all that, you're trying to do good, but you're doing it for the wrong reasons, how does it screw with your mind? And at what point do you snap, and at what point do you just throw up your hands and go, okay, you're never going to love me, so I'm just going to cut loose.
Mm. It's interesting because there's a lot of concern sometimes of people who read the book that we're actually just going to find out that Modius had brain-swapped with the
That's too easy. That's too, like, hypnotism, mind control. That's just the easy way out, man. It's just, that would be the biggest cheat in the world to find out that, oh, it's actually an alien being in his brain that's controlling him, or he's been hypnotized by his greatest foe. Screw that. You know, this is a guy with legitimate emotional problems.
Mm-hmm. I loved what we discovered about Modius, that he has sort of an emotional tie. This is sort of a Joker Batman relationship with the Plutonian. There's a love interest.
Yeah, it's a lot more twisted than Batman Joker, which is just saying something. It's the notion that, again, look at the irony of that. His greatest enemy is, in fact, someone who loves him pretty much unconditionally. And, of course, Plutonium is not going to embrace that either. So I think that goes to the state of both men's mental disrepair.
It's interesting because they end up on opposite sides, and yet in some ways they're very similar.
Yeah, that's the way it is with most great villains. So
it's really cool because I noticed when you started to talk about it, you snickered just a little bit. I guess in some ways there is this within you desire to sort of surprise us.
Yeah.
And because, you know, that surprised me. When I was reading the book, I went, whoa.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I didn't realize that's what Modius was coming from. And it's a very interesting thing. I always love a good surprise. There's nothing better than a good surprise. And you do that a lot, which is one of the reasons why I've been buying your books for as long as I have. And Irredeemable, it's a great read. It was great when you got your chance to write again. I missed your writing for a while you were editing. I wanted to get real quickly in touch on Incorruptible.
Sure.
Because I love the character Max Damage.
Thank you.
That name, when I read that, I thought, if that's not a villain name, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
And again, because we see the Plutonian as a bad person, or a good person who's apparently, quote-unquote, bad, now we see the opposite take place. Again, this is one of those things, when it happens, I just sit there and go, oh, that makes such sense. Of course, we've got to have somebody who's going to try to take him on, and it just makes sense for one of the villains, particularly one who can actually stand up to the Plutonian.
Yeah, exactly.
Again, this is one of those things that makes sense. The interesting thing about that book to me is to watch the character struggle with elements of his past that he still has to deal with.
Well, that's just it. He's, you know, again, the villain who has turned hero. The problem he has is that I think it's much easier for a hero to be villainous because I think we all, in our dark places, we have moments where we are selfish and some of us are, even more than others, are constantly trying to overcome our own selfish impulses. But we all know what they are. Whereas a villain who becomes a hero, in his case, you know, his big problem is the only definition he has of what a hero does is the opposite of what a villain does. And that's not a very good definition. It's not a very good guiding principle. Because what does that mean, to do the opposite of what a villain does? And so his constant struggle is that, you know, is that there's no roadmap for this. And he also has the same sort of attitude about this, or the same sort of perspective on being a superhero as, and I don't use this comparison capriciously, the same sort of comparison that an alcoholic has towards reforming and not drinking anymore, which is that you have to just draw a line in the sand. There's no tapering off, or else you're alcoholic and you can be sober for 5 years and then one drink will send you back teetering over the edge. And Max feels the same way about villainy. He's got to hew the straight and narrow because he doesn't know where the lines are. He doesn't know where the boundaries are. And so he's secretly terrified of slipping down the slope again without even realizing it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's got to be extra, you know, moral and extra strict with his own ethical and moral boundaries.
Which is interesting because jailbait is an interesting part of that.
Which isn't because he had a sidekick named Jailbait. Yeah.
Well, the thing, what gets me is that, you know, how long have superheroes had, you know, underage sidekicks going around with them?
Right.
Batman and Robin. You know, suddenly Max realizes here he's got this young girl who's underage going around with him, and he can't bring himself to have her continue, and yet he can't seem to let her go also. And I just wondered, is that like a commentary on young sidekicks in the comics industry? And in some ways, it's so ridiculous, and yet in other ways, you need that for the young kids to be able to have someone to identify with.
That's true. You know, honestly, it was just, the answer there is that it was really kind of just a joke. I just thought it was an interesting name for a sidekick. Kick was jailbait, the 16-year-old girl, because it just makes them immediately creepy.
Well, it's just fascinating to me because to me it's sort of like a commentary on all this about teenage sidekicks and Robin and all the other people who have been drafted into the war that the main hero's onto. And, you know, I find his struggles over that. You know, he wants to get rid of her. He wants for her to go back home, but she won't do it. And so he's still sort of stuck with her. It's fun to watch that, given in light of all the commentary about sub-teen heroes who are who go along and do that. So I think that's an interesting part of it. I heard a rumor that it was likely that Empire might be returning.
Actually, just a rumor as far as I know. So it's just a rumor going around.
Well, Empire was a great comic. It was, what if Dr. Doom had beaten Superman and found a way to benefit from that?
Yeah, and then what happens once you're king of the world is that everybody else wants a piece of you. So.
Yeah. it's not as much fun as you think it's going to be.
Exactly.
But that was a great comic. If you ever get a chance to bring that back, I would love to see it.
I would love to. I mean, the part of the problem we have just is that Barry Kitson and I always end up working in different companies these days, and so once at some point our his exclusives will be up, and we'll be able to do something somewhere. So,
well, one last question. We talked a little bit about the future of comics. Personally, where do you see comics going in the next 10 or 15 years? Do you think that we'll still be doing paper comics, or are we going to have like a little CD, or are we going to go to an FTP site and download the comics and read them on our computer? What do you think is going to happen as far as comics in the future?
I think all of the above. I think that we'll still probably have print comics. We'll still probably have paper comics because there's still something about the medium that is enjoyed. And it's easy for us to... I live in Los Angeles, where everybody walks around with an iPhone all the time. It's easy for me to forget. It's easy for us to forget that, if you live in East Jesus, Iowa, your likelihood of having an iPad is a lot less likely. So there's that, there's the collectability factor. There's the idea that people still like having a souvenir that they can have signed at conventions. But certainly, there's no question that digital is a huge part of the future. We just haven't figured out how to harness it yet. It's the Wild West, but we're all working on it because we all know that this is where we need to concentrate our efforts because this is that once more makes us a mass medium. Because what we've done so successfully and beautifully over the last 30 years is we've successfully taken comics, we've successfully taken a mass medium and turned it into a niche market. Yay us. So this is a chance to reverse that trend.
Okay. Again, we talk with Mark Wade. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Since that interview was recorded, Mr. Wade's been busy with a lot of different things, including Marvel's Digital Infinite Comics, in which he's been working with Stuart Immonen on many different stories, including Nova, apparently. He's also doing another website called Thrillbend with more digital comics. Now, of course, he hasn't abandoned paper comics completely. He's still doing Daredevil for Marvel, which is doing very well. And he's also writing the upcoming series for Steed and Mrs. Peel, the ongoing book for Boom Studios. And he's going to have the original Avengers and the original Hellfire Club, as I like to advertise in that. So Mr. Wade is always a good thing. If you see his name on the cover, be sure to buy it because you're going to get a good story. Be back next week when we have more news, previews, interviews, and reviews. But until then, keep reading your comics.
So I leave, knowing that a world full of heroes has nothing to fear.